Good evening. It's Monday, August 3rd, 2020, and this is Ozarks at Large. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead tonight, a protest yesterday in Boone County as the KKK is challenged. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich will have that report. Tomorrow afternoon on Here and Now, the October surprise. Like announcing a possible Vietnam peace deal days before the 1972 election, or in 2016, when FBI Director James Comey announced an update on that agency's investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email system during her tenure as Secretary of State. A history of October surprises on tomorrow's Here and Now from NPR and WBOR Boston, beginning at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon on 91.3 KUAF. Arkansas's Department of Health is reporting 787 new cases of COVID-19 in the past 24-hour monitoring period and an additional 11 deaths in Arkansas from the virus. 475 Arkansans have now died from coronavirus since the start of the pandemic. There were 6,357 tests administered in the past 24 hours. The state ended July with more than 194,000 tests performed during the month. At today's press briefing in Little Rock, Governor Asa Hutchinson discussed the future of testing in Arkansas as the pandemic continues.
I mentioned before that we wanted to look at the acquisition of antigen testing equipment, and I'm pleased to say that we have now received 100 BD Veritor new antigen testing machines. They have been received. They are in place. You can see a picture of those. And we have 100 more of these on order, and we have not yet received the testing kits that are necessary for this, but we have received the testing equipment, and we look forward to receiving the rest of it. And our plan is to assign these new BD Veritor antigen equipment to our public health units, with a priority of utilizing the quick turnaround test, our point of care test, for our K through 12 educational systems. In other words, if there's a teacher, if there's a staff person, if there's a student that needs to have a quick test, then they can go there to the local health unit, get a quick turnaround on this equipment that we'll be deploying over the next 3 weeks.
The governor says the state's goal for testing in August will be 190,000 tests plus 10,000 additional antigen tests for a total of 200,000 tests for August. The governor says he's still concerned about the positivity rate that, for the past 7 days, continues to hover around 10% in Arkansas. Sebastian County reported the most new cases in the most recent monitoring period, 87. The governor says the state is keeping a close watch on the county and western Arkansas.
It's about large gatherings. It's about behavior. It's about being disciplined in social distancing as well as wearing masks. I've seen a couple of activities there that was not as good as they should have been. So I think we learn from those as we go through it, and hopefully everyone in the River Valley will pay attention and to make sure they do their part to reduce the spread.
Washington County is reporting 66 new cases in the most recent 24-hour period, and Benton County, 42. The governor also notes it's been 2 weeks since the state's mask mandate went into effect. He says he appreciates the businesses posting multiple signs supporting that mandate. He says research suggests it takes at least 2 weeks for a mask mandate to begin to have an effect.
But the impact all depends upon the level of compliance. Now, anecdotally, it looks to me like it's improved the mask usage by the fact that there's been a mandate in place. It's certainly not 100%, but it has increased it. And so if there is compliance, you'll start seeing a difference, and we hope to see that.
Dr. Jose Romero, the state's acting Secretary of Health, says it's also time to think about another health issue, influenza.
We start vaccinating against influenza this time of year, and we go forward. This year, I want to stress the importance of influenza vaccine for everyone. And the reason why is that there are a significant number of deaths each year from influenza. We don't know what the confluence of influenza infection and COVID will be. Will that lead to increased mortality, morbidity? We know that there's a press on our emergency rooms during influenza season. One way to decompress that is to try to get people immunized against it. And again, these individuals that develop severe influenza become hospitalized. They can wind up in our intensive care units, use intensive care beds, and may require ventilators, which we will need for COVID. So this disease is preventable. We can do it. The vaccine is safe. It doesn't cause disease. Health providers have been taking this vaccine for decades. I have over 20 years of receipt of the vaccine every year. So it's important to go forward with this. I will be periodically reminding people to get their vaccines.
The briefings with the governor and state officials are archived in their entirety at the governor's YouTube channel. The Oklahoma State Department of Health released new figures related to the virus this morning. There are currently 628 Oklahomans hospitalized with complications from COVID-19, and there have been 551 deaths from the virus in Oklahoma. And the Cherokee Nation is urging masks to be worn as the number of positive cases there goes up. A press release this morning from the nation's headquarters in Tahlequah lists the number of positive cases in the nation rising from 219 to 684 in the past 30 days. That press release attributes the rise in cases to gatherings where social distancing measures and proper mask usage have not been observed, according to the tribe's public health team. This is the first Monday in August, and this is Ozarks at Large. Early voting begins tomorrow for a special election in Bethel Heights and Springdale. Registered voters will be casting their ballot for or against the consolidation of the city of Bethel Heights into the city of Springdale. Tomorrow is also the last day you can have an absentee ballot mailed to you. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
The annexation effort is the result of Bethel Heights residents gathering enough signatures for a special election. Springdale Mayor Doug Sprouse says several months ago he started receiving requests from Bethel Heights residents having issues with sewage seeping onto their property. Mayor Sprouse says the residents decided the best way to get results was to organize a petition drive to get the consolidation issue on the ballot.
We looked over the situation, our water and sewer utility, as well as the city as a whole. And we can well serve the residents of Bethel Heights without a detriment to our current residents in the city of Springdale. And so we agreed to take those residents should the citizens elect to do so. And this type of consolidation, it hasn't been done very much, but how it has to work is that residents of Springdale vote and the residents of Bethel Heights vote, and it has to pass in both municipalities for it to become effective.
Wastewater issues in Bethel Heights have been ongoing for some time. According to a lawsuit filed by the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality in March, several violations were uncovered by inspections conducted by ADEQ in 2019. The mayor of Bethel Heights did not respond to our requests for comment for this story. If the measure to consolidate Bethel Heights into Springdale is approved, Bethel Heights residents would become part of Springdale, and Mayor Sprouse says Springdale City services would be provided to them, including access to a water and sewer utility.
Their sewer rates will reduce drastically. Their water rates also, they already get their water from the city of Springdale, but we also have a lower water rate for residents of the city. So we have an outside rate, and then for those who are part of the city of Springdale. So their water rates will also go down.
There will be a cost for Springdale Water Utilities to fix the sewer problem, but Sprouse says they have reserves in place. He says Springdale has a water and sewer commission, and the utility is run more like a business in that it's ratepayer-supported rather than taxpayer-supported.
They have amassed a good amount of reserves to be able to handle things without having to bond for them in the future. And so they estimate that the quick fix running some bypass and to fix the immediate problem and to provide sewer for the residents of Bethel Heights will probably be in the neighborhood of $200,000. That's a bypass system that would be put in place quickly and would get it to our treatment plant. Okay. And then, so the old drip field and the step system that Bethel Heights currently uses would be abandoned.
Mayor Sprouse says the city would have some cleanup to take care of there, and the long-term solution is to run sewer lines.
And they are confident they can do that with the reserves in place. And the main thing to know is that Bethel Heights will have they'll have sewer service almost immediately. And long-term, that will be fixed permanently. And they will be permanently hooked on to our sewer system. That will take obviously a little more time, but it won't cost any more money to the Bethel Heights residents. The city of Springdale or the Springdale Water Utilities have money in reserves to make that long-term fix without any increase in rates to anybody.
According to the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission is delaying a decision on a proposed $11.2 million project to address Bethel Heights' wastewater system until after the special election. The multi-million dollar loan would fund construction of a pump station and pipeline to take wastewater from the city to a treatment plant run by the Northwest Arkansas Conservation Authority. For current residents of Springdale, Mayor Sprouse says consolidation would not increase any of their water and sewer rates.
It's all pluses for the residents of Springdale. It gives us a great growth opportunity to the north for future growth to the northeast. It does not overburden our current police department, fire department, public works, and revenue comes with the annexation too. You know, just as we'll have more expenditures with more residents, we'll also have more revenue because of more residents. Our state turnback will be increased because that's per capita. And so we should gain enough revenue to offset any increase in personnel that we'll need to apply.
Springdale is located mostly in Washington County, but a portion of the city is located in Benton County. Bethel Heights is also in Benton County, and because of that, the election commissions in both counties will be working on this election. Jennifer Price, Director of Elections for Washington County, says she's coordinated with Benton County in previous elections, but with the COVID-19 pandemic, they've been coordinating with other counties as well on how to best keep voters and poll workers safe.
We've actually been coordinating not only with Benton County, but with Crawford, Carroll, and Sebastian County as well, all the counties in this area, to kind of make sure we're all on the same page and following the same types of procedures at our polling locations. And so we have been meeting twice a month through Zoom since April, making plans, discussing, working with the Secretary of State's office and the governor's office on different issues so that we have a well-coordinated effort here in Northwest Arkansas.
The goal of the new procedures is to reduce interaction between voters and poll workers as much as possible, an effort that starts as soon as someone walks through the door of a polling center.
You'll be greeted by a poll worker when you come in. That poll worker will hand you your blank ballot and also give you, it's a stylus that says I voted on it, that is yours to use while you're in the polling location. So that's the closest contact you're going to have with a poll worker when you come into the polling location.
At the check-in station, voters will show ID, but poll workers will no longer touch it.
We'll ask you to state your name, your address, and all that information we normally ask you to state. But now we actually will have a plexiglass shield between the poll worker there and the voter. You will use that provided stylus that we gave you to sign your name in the poll book. So we're not sharing stylus at that station. And then you'll also be responsible for putting your own ballot into the printer there that prints the precinct that you live in.
From there, voters head to the express vote machine and place their ballot into the marking device. Price says they've updated instructions on the screens in hopes of eliminating the need for poll workers to walk voters to the machine and explain the voting process, as they've done in the past. However, Price says poll workers are still there to answer any questions voters may have.
And at the DS 200, where you place your ballot, We'll also be providing hand sanitizer. We'll have hand sanitizer throughout the polling location, but we definitely want you to take advantage of it before you leave the polling location. And then you're free to take that I voted stylus with you, or you can recycle it, and then we would sanitize it and use it at a future election.
Because of concerns about the coronavirus, there could be a shortage of poll workers across the country. Locally, Price says she's seen a lot of polling stations lose 5 or 6 people that won't be able to work in the general election.
But I am encouraged that we are getting a couple of applications each week for brand new poll workers. So it will take some shuffling for us when we get into the general election. It may mean that we have to consolidate a few polling locations to make sure that we're fully staffed at the polling locations that we have open. We're taking a real good look at all of our locations, making sure that there's enough space in that location to accommodate voters to wait in line and social distance our voting equipment so it can be safely social distance from everything.
Even with all the safety precautions in place, if voters don't feel comfortable voting in person, they can fill out a form requesting an absentee ballot. If they miss the deadline to have one mailed to them, they can also pick one up in person or send a designated bearer to pick one up.
So, for instance, if you were unable to come and pick up one, you can designate someone to be able to pick one up for you. There's definitely options. We have all of this listed on our website. If voters want more in-depth information, they can go to our website or always feel free to call our office because we're happy to answer any questions voters have.
Polls are open from 7:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. on Election Day. For more information on absentee ballots, early voting, and polling sites, visit co.washington.ar.us or bentoncountyar.gov. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Siloam Springs also has a municipal election scheduled for August 11th. Residents can cast their votes for positions 5, 6, and 7 on the city's board of directors. If no candidate receives a majority of votes in the primary, the two candidates receiving the highest number of votes will be the nominees for the respective offices to be voted on at the November 3rd general election. More information can be found at SilomSprings.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Over 80 Black Lives Matter protesters intended to caravan to a Wilderness Ku Klux Klan compound in Boone County yesterday to confront longtime KKK leader Tom Robb. Instead, as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, they ended up in the nearby town of Zinc, where they were met by as many as 200 armed white nationalist militia and KKK supporters.
Aaron Clark, leader of Bridge the Gap NWA, has been planning for months to protest at the gate of a wilderness compound where Tom Robb, head of the Knights Party USA, has operated for nearly 40 years.
Yes, there will be armed militias there to counter-protest us. This is going to be a serious historical march into the heart of racism.
The Ku Klux Klan and other white nationalist groups have long staked a claim on Boone County, where a racial cleansing destroyed an African-American neighborhood in nearby Harrison over a century ago. Several Black Lives Matter protests have taken place recently in Harrison, but this is the first KKK-targeted protest.
No justice!
No peace!
We freedoms know the KKK has got to go!
As storm clouds threatened, both sides mingled for a time, appearing agitated, but were later separated by law enforcement. The Black Lives Matter protesters came to confront Knights Party leader Tom Robb, who's rebranded himself in recent years as nonviolent. We called him up last week to find out what he planned to do. He declined to be interviewed for this report, but did say he's referred to as Gandhi of the KKK. Towards late afternoon, Clark and co-organizer Jessica Angelica served up a barbecue dinner, inviting everyone to eat.
Hey, we got some barbecue over here for you. Barbecue. You guys, we are heroes today. We are the first group to take a stand for what we know is right and for what we believe in. And at the same time, we came down here and we bridged the gap. We offered food to the community. We are out here showing and setting the tone and setting the example for a peaceful protest.
No takers, although the demonstration did end without conflict. Last night by phone, Clark said he was relieved the protest was nonviolent, but things did get heated for a time.
We came down very peacefully. We even talked to some of the militia. We even offered to take water to the militia, and we still got hate spewed at us. a gentleman threw a watermelon on the ground and was like, here, broke it, and was like, Black Lives Splatter. So these are the reasons why we're trying to put eyes on this situation. This is the reasons why we're trying to let people know that Zink and Harrison, man, they're hot zones for racism.
Clark said his Facebook feed filled with vitriol yesterday.
It's just like, what? Like, okay, you're really dumb enough to post this on my live after we just came down there and tried to feed your community food? This is why we're there. This is why we're doing what we're doing. This is why we're marching. This is why you guys are Klan sympathizers. This is why we're marching on Thomas Rye, because this is the message of hate that he spread through these communities for since the beginning of time.
Clark says he plans to return to Boone County with even more followers.
The next march, we're hoping to have the numbers to be able to go down to in front of the compound or something like that.
Adding fuel to the fire in Boone County is a stunt video making the rounds produced by California resident Rob Bliss. Seeking to attract clicks and cash, Bliss, who is white, stood on the streets of Harrison for several days in early July, holding a Black Lives Matter sign, discreetly recording stray racist and hateful comments. Bliss compressed the most heinous comments into a two-minute clip, which is attracting millions of views, as well as national media coverage. Here are a few that don't contain foul language.
Hey, all lives matter, not just black.
This right here is the biggest hoax there ever was.
But yeah, black lives do matter, but what about ours, man?
Apparently, black people's lives matter more than us.
What Bliss apparently didn't do is connect with the Harrison Task Force on Race Relations, working for 15 years to reconcile and repair Harrison's violent racial history. We queried Harrison's mayor, Jerry Jackson, who provided a written statement denouncing Bliss's video, calling it a hit job, noting that Bliss had posted a GoFundMe page after publishing it online, collecting thousands of dollars. The mayor concedes that racism persists in his city and county, but progress is being made. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
On July 24th, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson announced a coronavirus outbreak had occurred in Newton County, most cases involving elders. Several days later, a source with Arkansas Healthcare Association reportedly said multiple residents and staff had tested positive for COVID-19 at a skilled nursing facility in Jasper, with deaths. The facility is locked down. Mayor Jan Larson says town residents are devastated by the outbreak.
Well, I was stunned, I think, as everybody else, because we know we have a wonderful nursing home. We know the people who work there. We know the people who are residents. Many of them are our relatives or our friends. And it's just been an awful frustrating situation, and I know, I think I think we all feel that way.
Newton County, according to the Arkansas Department of Health, has had 91 positive cases since the outbreak began. According to Arkansas Center for Health Improvement data, as of July 27th, the city of Jasper, population 433, has 24 positive coronavirus cases, nearly 5% of the population. Of those, 19 are active cases. Mayor Larson says she's concerned the virus will continue to spread through the town, so she's been warning residents.
Well, naturally, we're very concerned, and I think everybody here is. I have seen more people wearing masks. We have made masks that we've shared with our businesses prior to this ever happening. The people here are very caring, very concerned. We really did a great job here from the beginning. For a long time, we had none, and then I have no idea how this came here or how it spread. I know they're working very hard to deal with it. It's just a day-by-day thing, and it's not. The frustrating thing is we have so little knowledge and so little control of how to deal with something like this. We're all learning.
Jasper is a popular summer tourist destination. And the mayor says recreational outfitters, cabin rentals, and restaurant operators are wary of outsiders bringing in the virus.
I think they are. I think the restaurants, many of them closed, and they've tried their best to follow the directives. I think they are. We know our economy needs, we need tourists for our economy. But we want everyone to be safe, and I think that the people in Jasper are doing their best to make that happen.
Just below 2% of all positive coronavirus cases in Arkansas have been diagnosed in nursing homes, according to the Arkansas Department of Health. This is Ozarks at Large.
From Little Rock, Arkansas, Issues and Answers, the award-winning interview program.
If this were 1974 and you heard that music, you would be settling in for, well, the biggest show in the state in 1974, a debate between Senator J. William Fulbright and Governor Dale Bumpers. Here to walk us through what happened in 1974 is Randy Dixon. He is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. He's brought us some archives that come from KATV that are being digitized. Randy, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Kyle? Thanks for having me on.
You bet. I am excited because having your senior senator and the sitting popular governor go at each other in a debate just, what, not even 72 hours before the election. Wow. That was something.
Well, and that was not only huge in Arkansas, but it was nationally broadcast.
Right. And so, we'll get to that in a few minutes.
ABC,
yeah.
Issues and Answers. But, you know, this was a very big primary race in 74. You know, as you said, Bumpers was the governor. He was second term. And even at 48 years old, he was considered kind of a relative newcomer, because he had been in office for 3 years, and before that, he came out of nowhere. Fulbright was running for his sixth term, so he'd been in office since 1945.
Now, as we're closing in on Election Day in November 1974, it's interesting because generally it's the incumbent that kind of shies away from a debate, and it's the quote-unquote upstart challenger that wants to firm up a debate. What was the situation like in 1974?
Well, Fulbright originally brought it up, and he wanted to debate, and Bumpers initially kind of resisted.
Senator Fulbright has said he would debate you, but he would not initiate such a debate. Would you initiate a debate?
I would be reluctant to say right now what I would do between now and May 28th.
Yeah.
I don't see any point in getting into it at this time, though.
And Senator Fulbright would not let this go, would he?
No, he continued to make it an issue and brought it up at all of his news conferences. And I talked to Hoyt Purvis this morning. And, you know, along with being a longtime professor of journalism here at the university, he was press secretary and aide to Senator Fulbright. And he was there on staff during this campaign, was actually there at the debate. But he said that that Bumpers, having been in office for 3 years as governor, had gotten a lot of exposure. So he was polling fairly well. He had a comfortable lead. And so their thought was that a debate would kind of turn things around. As Hoyt put it, they had nothing to lose. So here is Senator Fulbright bringing up the issue of Bumpers balking at a debate.
It's up to the people's judgment as to which can serve them. If he does not wish to engage in discussion of the issues, that's his privilege. I can't, I cannot control what he does. I think the issues are important. These issues, many of them are extremely difficult, and I have tried always as the representative to take positions, and I have sometimes had some difficulty in persuading my colleagues as well as my constituents that my judgment was a correct one. It really comes down to a question of judgment, I guess. It's not easy to determine what really is in the interest of the people of Arkansas and the nation. Of course, we're part of Arkansas, and we can't disassociate ourselves from those policies. But as a freshman senator, I can assure you, you have very little influence.
Senator Fulbright pushing for a debate in 1974. We finally got to one. And it, as you alluded to earlier, it was on a national stage.
Yes. And Bumpers did agree eventually to do this, but he wanted to limit it to 30 minutes on the Sunday before the election.
Charges that you're trying to deceive the public by not having a television debate.
Well, you know, I remember in 1968, Charles Bernard asked him, as if I recall, several times to debate, and he elected not to do it. I've said that I would be happy to meet him on Sunday morning before the Tuesday election for a 30-minute discussion of the issues. He says, I'm ducking the tough ones. He ought to load them up, and I'll be happy to answer them for him at that time.
All right, so it's going to be ABC Issues and Answers. Issues and Answers was the Sunday morning show that that network had before it was This Week with David Brinkley, and that, of course, before the current This Week with George Stephanopoulos. This was on national television.
And it was broadcast live from the KATV studios out of Little Rock.
Hmm.
And it was hosted by two ABC reporters, Bob Clark from the White House, and then Frank Reynolds, who eventually became the main anchor for ABC in the 80s.
Governor Bumpers, Senator Fulbright, we're delighted to have you with us today. I understand this is your first joint television appearance, and probably it will be your last before the campaign ends on Tuesday. Because our time is limited, we thought we would begin by asking each of you to take just a moment or so, let's say a minute, to state your case to the people of Arkansas and the country. We've already had the toss of the coin, and Governor Bumpers, you won, so you start.
Frank, thank you. First of all, I'd like to say that I have felt, and one of the reasons I decided to make this race, that the Congress has become, I think, increasingly insensitive to domestic issues. I think that there has to be a building of a very strong state-federal relationship. That same relationship needs to be developed between the local communities and the federal government. The federal government must understand. And I would work to change the system because I don't think it served us well.
Thank you, Governor. Senator Fulbright?
Well, I very much appreciate your getting us together. I had attempted to have a longer discussion with the governor, but didn't wish to do that. I, of course, feel that the governor, I notice, says seniority didn't serve the country well. I'm not running for national office. I'm running for senator from Arkansas. And I'm quite certain the seniority system has served Arkansas very well and continues to, and will always when it's a small state. So the reason I'm running, I have had 30 years' experience. I am a senior member of the Senate. I think I can be of great help and value to this state, and that decision should be to the people. I could have, of course.
So there it is, a national audience watching on the Sunday morning before Election Day. And remember, no early voting back then. No votes have been cast yet. Interestingly, I love this next cut that you've provided, Randy Dixon, because it brings up the old political point that careful what you say 25 years prior, because an opponent eventually will bring it back against you. In this case, talking about seniority and how long one should be in the Senate.
He defends the seniority system, and I attribute to the seniority system a part of the reason the Congress cannot be responsive. And I might add that the senator felt the same way in 1946. He made statements to the effect that the legislative process in this country had to be brought up to date. That the Congress was going to lose the respect of the people in this country if the seniority system was not abolished.
Governor, you probably answered this question here in Arkansas, but Arkansas is, of course, one of the great beneficiaries of the seniority system. You have, along with Senator Fulbright, you have Senator McClellan, who's now the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and Wilbur Mills, the chairman of the extremely powerful House Ways and Means Committee. Would you, if they were up this year, would you feel equally inclined to run against either of them on the same principle?
Well, let me say this. They're two very able men. And I've never said that anybody should be precluded from serving as a chairmanship because of his tenure. But I simply say it should not be an absolute. I think the people in the Congress, it has nothing to do with one's intelligence, one's integrity, one's knowledge of the subject matter of that committee. It's simply based on tenure. And these men are very able, and I would assume that they'd probably fare very well under a change system. But I'm saying that it should not be an absolute.
It's not an absolute. The next place, a man who's been reelected by his constituents is usually not a dummy. I mean, he says there's no relations to ability or intelligence. I submit that most of the members of Congress in either house who've been reelected time after time in a free election in this country have shown some capacity to respond to the desires and wishes of their people. This is the difference between the attitude of an executive officer, which the governor has been. He's never been in the legislature. He ran once for the legislature, but he was defeated because I think he had no taste for it. But he is an executive, and he completely disregards, I think, the significance of the legislature. He has a national point of view from the executive point of view. I think that our constitutional system is based upon the assumption the basic lawmaking power is the Congress. That's what the Constitution gives. Right now, the power of impeachment is given to the Congress. That's the final, ultimate test at where is the real power lodged. The Congress has the power to remove the president. The president hasn't the power to move the Congress. And I think what we're in the process of doing is reestablishing the proper balance between the executive and the legislature.
A sitting, well-known U.S. senator being challenged by a popular sitting governor. It's brought up that, you know, there are some Democratic voters who didn't really want to have to make the choice.
No, they didn't. And it was difficult in that Bumpers pretty much agreed with all of the issues that Fulbright stood for, except for maybe the seniority issue. And even though he attacked seniority, Bumpers sort of benefited from the feeling among voters that a younger man should be elected to start gaining the seniority that small states, you know, rely on for political clout, because it was known that Senator McClellan announced that he would retire in 78 and that Fulbright had also pledged that this would be his last term. So Arkansas would be left with what they would say green senators. So he was sort of benefiting from the idea of seniority, which he was strongly arguing against. But many of the supporters in the state, especially white moderates and liberals, had supported both men. So they were torn as who to support.
I have the impression that there's a good deal of pain connected with this.
A good deal of what?
A good deal of pain that people who like you both are torn between whether to support you, Senator Fulbright, or launch Governor Bumpers on a new career. Well, Governor, why did you choose now? Why didn't you wait 4 years?
Well, one of the reasons I just mentioned a moment ago, first of all, the state, I think, is in excellent condition. All of the things I talked about in 1970 that I'd like to do for the state of Arkansas, we've essentially completed. And the problems that are affecting the people of this state, such as the cost of living and health care and the administration of these federal dollars, those problems originate and can only be solved in Washington.
They did differ somewhat slightly on the economy, didn't they?
Yes. And Fulbright took the opportunity to kind of jump on him about it.
The governor says the other day, they across the board cut everything percentage-wise. I think that's the worst possible way. On one hand, he says he'd give leadership and direction to the government. I have stated, we've had this up before, I said I would cut those non-essentials. My view of what are the priorities, I would start out with foreign aid, going to the moon or the Skylab or Mars, whatever you call it. It was part of the space program. And the foreign bases, things that I call non-essential, non-reconstructive, and these enormous payments to people like Lockheed, the defense contractors, and Litton, who've demonstrated their inefficiency and wastefulness. Selective cutting of the budget seriously. My record will show I have voted this way.
At the end of this 30 minutes episode of Issues and Answers on ABC television, the candidates are offered a chance to wrap up, and they talk about who's going to win.
I wonder, we have only a minute or so left. Who's going to win this election?
I think I am, because the governor started out very, very much ahead. And as it is going along, he doesn't deny, I don't believe, that the gap is closed and we're about neck and neck.
Could we ask each of you at this stage to be candid with us in the last 30 seconds and tell us what your private polls show? Are you ahead or behind, Senator?
My private poll as of yesterday showed us we were 4 percentage points, 4/10 of a percentage head ahead. Now, you know that's so close, it's within the margin of error. That's why I say neck and neck.
I'll tell you that the polls we have seen do not show what Senator Fulbright says his show.
What do they show?
It show that we're well ahead.
Substantially ahead.
Well, I...
But the people will make that decision.
Sure,
the 28th,
they make
without
decision.
Us talking about what
but
our
this
polls
has
show.
Happened before. A governor who's here campaigning every day for 3 years obviously starts out ahead. But fundamentally, when they consider how important you are to the Senate, to this state, especially in the procurement of the basic public facilities, that's what makes the final decision.
Senator, we are ending on a rather happy position. The governor began the show. You got the last word. It's been a pleasure having both of you here with us on Issues and Answers.
Thank you for inviting us.
Good luck to you both.
Thank you.
If possible.
And we have the benefit of history here, Randy Dixon, don't we? We know who won.
Yes. Bumpers ended up with 65% of the vote to Fulbright's 35%.
Which was wide margin.
Now, yes, it was, but wait until the general election. He ran against an unknown Republican named John Jones, and Bumpers got 85% to Jones's 15%. Bumpers ended up serving four terms, you know, from 75 to 99, and many of those were with David Pryor.
That's right, because David Pryor would take over Senator McClellan's seat in just a couple of years.
Yes.
And all three of those men, Fulbright, Bumpers, and Pryor, have something on the university, a big something on the University of Arkansas named for them.
Absolutely.
College of Arts and Sciences for Fulbright, College of Agriculture for Dale Bumpers, and then the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History.
That's correct.
Well, this was exciting, and I'm going to again remind you that if you ever find any audio of a debate that took place in front of the Arkansas legislature between Phyllis Schlafly and Diane Blair about the ERA.
Man, I have been looking for that.
See, it doesn't, no one can find anything, any audio on this. It's the holy grail of Arkansas audio history.
It sure is.
If anybody out there has it, if it's on a cassette in your garage, let us know.
We want it.
You bet. Hey, once again, so fun walking through the past with you, Randy.
Yeah, that's great. And just be sure to, if you want to look at some of the old news film from the 50s, 60s, or 70s, just Google Pryor Center, P-R-Y-O-R, and go to the KATV section, and you can search through it. It's a lot of fun.
All right. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy, as always, thank you for your time and for your archives.
Great. We'll see you next Monday.
What is the glass on the moon? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. During the summer of 2019, China's U-22 rover discovered something with an unexpected color and luster during its travels on the far side of the moon. After a few tweets regarding the pictures, which piqued the curiosity of several lunar scientists, it appeared that the rover may have stumbled upon something like impact glass, which is created after a meteorite strikes the lunar surface and essentially melts the lunar soil. Now it appears that those scientists were actually right. The China Lunar Exploration Program has released even more photos of the substance, and the bright specks do resemble impact glass, known as impactite on Earth, and it's actually been seen on the moon before by previous Apollo 17 astronauts in 1972, which actually found orange soil that formed from molten lunar volcanic eruptions some 3.64 billion years ago. From Dan Moriarty of NASA Goddard, the shape of the fragments are very similar to the surrounding area, implying a similar geologic history. The most important information here is that the material is relatively dark. The material could have originated from two different sources. Either this material was excavated from deeper below the surface and then pushed up and out from the impact, or it could be a form of breccia, which are sedimentary rocks clumped together with lunar crust, basalt, and impact glass. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with your host, Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM, KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. This is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas.
This is Ozarks at Large. Thank you for being with us on this Monday. We know that the opportunities to get outside and to go do things still remain quite limited because of the pandemic. There are opportunities to experience entertainment, information, education online. Here's some examples. The Museum of Native American History in Bentonville is announcing an enhanced virtual museum experience. It's going to be available beginning tomorrow before closing doors to the public March due to COVID-19. Mona was chosen as a USA Today's top 10 history museum. The Mona Virtual Museum includes improved online content, an indigenous news outlet, a membership program, and an online gift shop. Mona will be hosting virtual workshops and programs every month beginning this month. If you'd like to know more, monah.us. You can experience Thomas Eccles' piece, Perspectives on the Unique Privilege of Breathing. That's the piece he wrote earlier this month for Trillium Salon Series' first artist residency at Mount Sequoia. You may remember we had him on this show in July. His piece and the performance is available on the Trillium YouTube page. If you'd like to know more, you can go to TrilliumSalonSeries.com. Also, last month, you remember we might have had, you might remember we had Robert Ginsburg from the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society discussing the Northwest Arkansas Jazz All-Stars Youth Ensemble. Well, that ensemble has produced two professional jazz music videos in lieu of their public concert that they usually do every summer. That concert this year canceled because of the pandemic. The high school musicians who make up the All-Stars rehearsed and recorded in small sections to produce video recordings of tunes like Count Bubba and others. The videos can be accessed on the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society website. That's digjazz.com. It's the fourth season of the All-Stars, a group of 15 high school musicians recruited from 9 Northwest Arkansas high schools. You can go to digjazz.com/youthjazz to learn more about the program.
A new NPR Ipsos poll reveals what Americans make of the federal response to the pandemic.
As they grapple with just how grave the situation is, I think they're looking for sweeping, really broad, powerful action here.
From school openings to mask requirements and a new relief package, how all of that might affect the November election on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Gentry, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to the show tonight included Antoinette Grajeda and Jacqueline Froelich. Jacqueline also provided sound information about Newton County and COVID-19. Our show mastered by Timothy Dennis. Caitlin Ahrens, Dr. Caitlin Ahrens, writes and hosts Scratching the Surface. It's produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Thanks, Randy Dixon from the Pryor Center, for your help today. I'm Kyle Kellums from the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Have a great rest of your Monday.